Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness, The Procession to Calvary, and Merchants and Marauders. This is Staying In. So, after
30 nicks.
After that many years.
Yeah. 30
years.
Why do people do that? Why do people make that sound? I've never seen it anywhere else in the world. People go, they say the number that they don't want to say, but it's just like, just say the number.
Yeah. Or they're trying to say something that they know is offensive.
Offensive, massively offensive. Yeah, yeah, there's that as well. Yeah.
Like, I'm going to say it, but I want you to know that I know it's offensive, but I'm still going to say it.
Look, I know I'm going to be racist now, okay? I know it. All right. But I'm going to say it in a weird way to call extra emphasis to it.
I know this is racist. Yeah. I know this is offensive. Yeah. And I'm continuing to do it. Don't be mistaken to think that I just don't know. I do know better.
I am ignorant, but I'm not ignorant of the fact that it is ignorant.
So, after
30 things, after 30 years,
I can finally say that I now have a skincare regime.
Okay.
Regime.
Okay.
I mean, you've always had a skincare regime.
Well,
to some degree. Right?
How much of that involved care is another question.
Yeah, what's changed about said skincare regime?
I've always had pretty bad skin, especially face.
Okay.
Face. That's not an offensive term, Sam. You have a face.
Yeah. I know, yeah.
Yeah.
I do have a face. So face, armpits, other areas. Bad.
Red zones.
Bad skin. Red zones, bad skin. Hair, right, really bad.
Okay.
And I've always, you know, struggled to keep it under control, and like it's, you probably wouldn't have like noticed it overtly, but I'm always very much like aware of it, especially when I'm playing like a board games and I look down, it looks like I've just eaten flapjack. And I just have to like generally like brush away like
bits of... Okay. I've just put two and two together as to what you've meant there. Okay, yeah. That's
And so I've struggled with it for ages and tried all different kinds of, you know, tinctures and tonics and anything that is brightly lit up in the supermarket and says, you know, this is going to fix your face. always tried it. Nothing's ever worked. But my wife, she uses a particular brand of skincare stuff. It's stuff called Tropic. I don't know if you've heard of it. Yeah. Like, it was set up by someone who won The Apprentice years and years ago, or was a contestant on The Apprentice or whatever.
What, that lad who runs Amstrad?
The lad who runs Amstrad, yeah. Yeah, Alan Michael Sugar. And so she got in touch with her brand ambassador. And the brand ambassador got in touch with me, and she's like, right, I'm going to put you together a borrow bag. And immediately I felt out of my depth.
What's a borrow bag, Sam? This sounds great. I want one of these.
So a borrow bag is effectively the first one's free.
Oh, no! Right.
So a borrow bag is a bag of like products that are not new. They've been kind of used and like passed around. Maybe they have like, sometimes they have like little tropic parties and like they try different things and spend lots and lots of money.
Mm-hmm.
And I suspect it's like demo products from that kind of stuff. And like basically she put it all in this bag for me. And like she was came around to my house and turned up at my doorstep and was just like, here's a cleanser, use this twice a day. Here's a balm, put this on. Here's some different like things that come in really, really tiny jars and are portioned out by pipette. And basically gave it to me in this little bag and like gave me a little regime to follow.
Mm.
And, you know, it's been incredible. Like, I have just like absolutely, for the first time in my life, like got like confidence back in like my face and my skin like feeling really good and like having a really good like regime to follow. I mean, it takes me ages to go to bed now, which is really frustrating because I just want to go to bed. I've brushed my teeth and now I've got to cleanse and I've got to balm and I've got to put on one of these things that's literally called an elixir. And in the morning, I've got to cleanse, I've got to moisturize, then use a product called and I can already hear Pete's eyes rolling in the back of his skull before I name the name this product. Rainforest Dew.
Yes. Is that a spray? Do you spray it and then have to slowly walk through it just so it kind of just glistens on your face?
No. It's by pipette, so I have to like pipette it.
Pipette it on my face. The traditional rainforest.
Well, but yeah. You know, not to beat around the bush, as it were, but you look radiant.
Thanks.
You look you look great, and here's the thing. Here's the thing, right? Thanks. Here's the thing. I think guys generally.
I think Pete's about to get real here.
Gather around for a second. I'm on beer number two. Huddle round. I think guys, we get to play on easy mode most of the time, right? Like we wake up and we look amazing, right? Like we look amazing all the time. We've got nothing to do. Don't have to put on any makeup. Don't have to brush your hair.
Were you going to say something like deodorant?
I just feel like he's accidentally nearly digging a big hole for himself.
Absolutely.
We don't even have to brush our teeth, clean our hands.
Wash our body in any way. But like, you know, we get to play on easy mode a whole bunch of the time. And I think if you're taking, and we get to be relatively confident about it, we get to go out and go, world, I woke up like this and I don't give a toss most of the time. But like, If that's what brings that level of confidence back, that's amazing, because like that is properly like that is the sort of thing that is like game changing, I would say, like for anybody, like being able to just like walk out the door and be like, I feel brilliant about myself, and like maybe I should get into some of this. Is this a secret ad, Sam?
This is going to come out, and in the end of it, we're going to hear Sam saying, "This episode was sponsored by."
Complete segue. I was talking to Sam about this the other day. A few months ago, I was doing a recipe where you make Biscoff pancakes, like Biscoff spread pancakes. In the recipe was ready breck. So we made the pancakes really nice, but we were left with this big box of ready breck. I was going to work the next day. I thought, I'll just start, you know,
treat myself,
taking massive chunks out of this, make a dent in the ready breck. Let's do that. Really good, honestly.
Yeah, it's so good. It's so good.
We bought more boxes of it. Like no excuse. That's my breakfast every morning. Ready breck.
Now we've come to a difficult part of the history of the podcast, which is quite good considering it's been going 151 episodes, where I'm convinced that Chris has talked about how good his rediscovery of ready breck has been on the podcast before, and I can't remember.
Over the course of this podcast, has he rediscovered it twice?
Look, it's kind of like that theory, isn't it? That different civilizations discover like mathematics and trigonometry like independently of one another. Except it's just Chris over and over again rediscovering ready breck.
Ready breck, yeah. I swear, I can't remember whether I know you have done, but I can't remember what episode it was and if I cut it out or not.
I think you cut it out because I listen to our podcast quite regularly. And it's not coming.
And you're waiting for the ready break.
No,
he's not put the ready break in.
He's not put it in.
He's cut that bit out. I'll bring it up again. Yeah.
No. Or maybe I cut it out.
Listeners won't know, but every episode Chris brings up ready break.
And every episode talks about ready break.
Without fail.
Yep.
This is the one that we let through.
I would quite like to watch Doctor Strange.
Okay. Well, you can do this. We're not stopping you.
Yeah.
Well, thanks, folks. So if we're going to talk about it, which I think we probably should, can we talk in a spoiler-free way?
Absolutely. We have to.
Yes, of course you can.
Is that all right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Can we do that?
And we'll just blame you for not having any spoilers.
Okay, fine. So I watched Spider-Man and the Other Spiders. Is that what it was called?
Yeah. Yep. That's exactly what it was called.
Spider-Man No Way Home.
Spider-Man No Way Home. Yeah, not the animated one.
Yeah, otherwise known as Spider-Man and the Other Spiders.
Not the Spider. Yeah, exactly. So, the latest Spider-Man movie, and I really, really liked it. And I think there were lots of really good bits. One of the really good bits was he gets to...
Spoilers.
Hang out early on with Doctor Strange. And if you've ever seen a Doctor Strange movie, you'll remember that one of the kind of, I guess, key visual things to it is that it likes to play a lot with like non-Euclidean geometry. Well, basically time and space kind of bends around, and that's represented by things like falling into a sky made of the city, for example, or those kinds of
like
things.
Like Inception.
And there was a really good bit of that in Spider-Man. I won't spoil it. It's really good and really creative and visually interesting. And it reminded me how much I like Doctor Strange as a movie concept. I've not really read any of the comic books. And there is a new one, and I am interested in watching it, but I've kind of fallen a little bit out of the Marvel thing. Like, I'm kind of like, I've not been keeping up with the TV shows. I've only been watching a few of the movies recently. And like, you three have watched it?
I went to see it first night it came out.
Or the premiere.
Does it continue the thing of like the original Doctor Strange, which is like...
It's a sequel.
It's a sequel.
But like in the... But
I know what you mean. I know what you mean in terms of, you know... And this is the interesting thing because, you know, Marvel, if you followed any of the recent films or any of the stuff like that, you know that Marvel are currently on this trajectory, on a very, very specific trajectory where they're slowly but surely, piece by piece, trying to introduce the concept of the multiverse, which is, you know, a well-known scientific idea where there are infinite universes and each universe there's infinite possibilities of anything could happen. So there's a universe where Pete has naturally green hair. There's a universe where Dan has 10 arms. There's a universe where Chris doesn't like Ready Break.
No, there's not.
And why it's taking so long to establish such a thing is that it's going to be a massive part of, you know, the narrative going forward between all of these films. That you know, that something's going to happen with the multiverse. You know, new characters are going to be coming in, but they look like the same old characters. And there's other characters who you don't know, but you kind of may recognize from other things, and suddenly it gets a lot more confusing. Like if you've ever read a comic book, several times both DC and Marvel have dabbled with the multiverse, and every single time they've done it, they've always had to press a big reset button and pull way back and just go, right, let's stop this because this is getting crazy.
The famous one being Crisis on Infinite Earths that essentially did it first, right, for DC, where they essentially went, it's a bit silly that we've got like four Supermans, so maybe we should...
Yes. Not.
Spoilers for 1970s comic book, get rid of a few of them.
Yeah. So, you know, it's quite understandable that, you know, and especially more than ever, because conceptually, it's bigger as a prospect and takes a lot more sort of processing to get your head around. Like Marvel are definitely taking their time with it because their philosophy has always been, you know, movies for kids, and you shouldn't have to watch 30 movies to understand what's going on in this movie. And what I've always loved about Doctor Strange, getting back to my point, is that he is the kind of the arbiter. He's the kind of conduit throughout what most of this storytelling has been done through, because he has, you know, he's a sorcerer. Like he dabbles and investigates and reads about these kind of mystical ideas and things going on in the universe. And so in Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness, literally through the title, they're going one step further and really trying to explore this idea of the multiverse, what it means, what ramifications it has, and what impact it's going to have on the future of, you know, the Marvel characters that we know and love. Mm-hmm. And the story's pretty simple. Doctor Strange is doing his thing and he bumps into this girl called America Chavez, who has a very unique ability of being able to move between multiverses. But she's being chased down by someone. And Doctor Strange goes on a journey to find out who that person who's trying to chase down America Chavez is. Because if this person finds America Chavez, then they are going to steal her powers and she will die if she loses her traversal powers. And that's it. That's all that needs to be really said. Because anything else, I feel, is going into spoiler territory.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah. I mean, that's primarily what the trailers kind of cover as well. That's the kind of the crux of everything there. So I don't think we've said anything there that's not been covered in any of the trailers.
No.
I kind of have a bit of mixed feelings about it. I really liked.
Of course.
I do. I mean, it's nothing like, I don't have mixed feelings in terms of like I did with Eternals, which I thought was real bad.
That's not a mixed feeling.
Yeah, that's not. That's a very strong singular feeling.
Yeah.
And I watched that for a second time and I felt exactly the same. I really enjoyed the first Doctor Strange.
Yeah.
I really did. And I was just a little bit disappointed kind of by this second one. It felt a little bit slow and a little bit kind of...
Really?
Yeah. I felt like the plotting of it felt quite kind of slow and kind of staccato. And I wasn't sure if that was kind of an element of like the nature of what the story was trying to do in terms of multiverses and jumping and all that stuff. Like maybe that was why it felt that way. It's directed by Sam Raimi, who's obviously famous for the original Spider-Man trilogy, but perhaps more famous for the likes of The Evil Dead and those mm-hmm. kind of films, Evil Dead and Evil Dead 2. It's a very much a Sam Raimi film. Like all of his kind of horror inflections are front and center. There's no mistaking them. There's not an element of kind of like, oh, this is a Marvel film and that shot over there, that's a Sam Raimi shot, but the rest of it is fairly standard. It's kind of that through line, the spine of it is kind of all Sam Raimi. Now, that's a good thing or a bad thing, depending on how your feelings are towards those kind of films. The likes of your Evil Dead and stuff like that. For me, I'm not in that world, and that kind of body horror kind of... there's kind of like the gruesomeness of that. And obviously, this is a Marvel film. It's not gruesome like The Evil Dead, but it pushes it as far as it can go. And there are lots of stuff where you can absolutely say, that's from that film. That is a callback to this. And that's fine. But it started to feel less like Doctor Strange by Sam Raimi. And it was Sam Raimi, oh, now I'm doing a Doctor Strange film kind of thing. It felt a little bit too much that way. And I lost a little bit of what I really liked from the original. Pete, you talk about kind of the visual style of Doctor Strange. And I think the original Doctor Strange, the visual style is one of the standout points of it.
Oh, yeah.
I felt it lost. I would have liked more from the second one. I think you lost some of that visual flair with that. Maybe it's because of the director's different and they aren't interested in that kind of thing. And I love all the stuff you talk about in terms of the geometry of the world. And it's what shows up in kind of Spider-Man No Way Home as well. You see some of that again. And it just, there are elements of it in Doctor Strange 2, but just not enough for me. And it didn't feel quite, I think that was one of the reasons I really struggled with it, because it was just, everything was just that I was a little bit disappointed with everything. I saw a lot of what was going to happen happening quite early on. And that wasn't because I'd seen trailers and stuff. It was because I know how kind of films work, and I was able to see certain things and be like, okay, that's going to happen, that's going to happen, and then we're done. I think I'm making it sound as if I disliked it more than I did. It was a 5 out of 10 for me. It was a fairly standard fare.
Dan, do you ever think about the multiverse version of you that kept his pledge to not actually watch any more of the Marvel films after their Endgame?
Yeah. Well, no, I thought about this.
Because you've been largely disappointed since you started carrying on watching the Marvel films.
I know. And you're leading me down a road that actually makes it seem like I'm more critical again. Like, I did have the view of, like, after Endgame, I was kind of done with it. Like, after Endgame and, like, Far From Home, which is kind of... That was kind of the bookend of that whole thing. And I was kind of done with it because I was kind of watching every single film, investing in all of them, loved it. And then I thought, well, I need something to talk about on the podcast. So I should probably keep watching these films. I wasn't as kind of invested in always going to the cinema to see them. I always kind of thought I'll continue with the characters that I know. The likes of Doctor Strange and Spider-Man and Guardians and Thor. I'll continue because they're not going to go on for too much longer because contracts run out and all that stuff. It's the new class I wasn't as interested in, the likes of Shang-Chi and Eternals. I wasn't that interested in going into them. And I have to say, having kind of gone back on that somewhat, because I'm going to be talking about them, I should really watch them. Like, it's lost a hell of a lot of steam, I think. Other than Spider-Man, none of them have made me go, yes, here we go. Here's the big oomph that I needed. I'm waiting to see the gears start cranking up again, and I'm just not really seeing it. I'm not getting that feeling of, okay, I'm back on, I'm getting excited again. I'm just kind of like, okay, well, maybe the next film will do it. Now I'm thinking, okay, Thor Love and Thunder's coming. Maybe that will be the one. Guardians 3, that's coming. Maybe that will be the one that gets it back on. And I never had that before. I was enjoying the films as they were. Opposed now, I'm just a bit cold to them, actually.
It's interesting because, like, I don't think you'll ever get anything like Endgame. And I don't think they should ever strive for that, really, because that's lightning in a bottle. It's a bit like The Matrix Resurrections. They made a conscious decision not to try and out Kung Fu and out action what they'd done before, because there's just really no point, because it's kind of lightning in the bottle, really. And I'm still trying to process Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness, because Sam and I saw it last night. Of date of recording, and it was this roller coaster for me, and trying to describe and find the language to review a roller coaster, it seems almost like you're trying to, it's almost like it is mad, this film. And in the same way that when you watch Thor Ragnarok, you go, yeah, this is Taika Waititi, this is their stamp, this is very much a Sam Raimi film, as you say, Dan. And I found it quite refreshing to have those brushstrokes of a director so clearly defined. This wasn't a director stepping up and trying to emulate what Scott Derrickson did, even though, you know, Derrickson's an executive producer of this, in the same way that Waititi wasn't interested in terms of what the previous directors of Thor had done. This is very much a Raimi film, and it's our first ever Marvel horror film. So for me, that's the way in which they're going forwards. Okay. It's about experimenting with different genres or subgenres.
Yeah.
I'm all for that. Now, the trade-off with that is obviously there's more chance of me coming across a Marvel property that I'm not going to enjoy as much, because all of them up until this have just been known as comic book movies. And to have something that in this case is a horror comic book movie, and there's genuine jump scares in this, genuine. And I can't remember the last time I had that really in a Marvel film. And it's...
I don't like them.
It's bonkers. It is a bonkers film, and I can't quite process it. It's quite telling that the title is a riff off The Mountains of Madness, for example. And I think the plotting of it, and a lot of people have kind of dismissed its script, Gary Waldron's script, as being a little bit simplistic and just exposition, which, you know, I kind of agree to an extent. Although what gives me solace is this was the lead writer, I believe, of Loki, which is a series I really, really enjoyed. But it is very much a Sam Raimi film. So for any of you who have watched Raimi, that interesting juxtaposition of scary and goofy is a very much a Raimi trademark, where you cannot be completely horrified because he'll just do something strange with the camera that would just make you go, okay, Sam.
A snap like close up or like
focusing on like an eye.
And
there's a sequence, Pete, where you've got talking about what a character's doing, and there's that character in the middle doing their thing, and then the two characters in the present scene who are listening to this are overlaid left and right, and this wonderful kind of, it was like a 90s music video. And I think, yeah, there's no way Derrickson would have really done that. There's no way any other director would have tried and done that. There's a sequence where, almost like Looney Tunes style, it does a fade to black, which is like, I can't remember the technical term for it, but essentially it transitions to black around a little circle. So everything fades and then it's just left. Like you're looking for at a mouse hole. I haven't seen that. It's like in the same way that you see those wonderful star wipes in Star Wars, the transitions, they get away with that. Raimi has his own way of working. And this is the most Raimi film I've seen in a while, since probably Drag Me to Hell. He never took this much risk with Spider-Man. I think the closest we got to kind of Raimi, apart from the filming of Willem Dafoe's and Green Goblin, was the actual transformation scene of Spider-Man. If you think about it, it was actually quite dark.
Mm.
He's in his room, lightning flashing outside, a flash on his face and it's a skull, cuts away, then you see spiders crawling up his DNA, like miniature spiders crawling up his DNA. Got a little bit of a taste of Raimi there.
Well, you had the whole the Dr. Octopus in the surgery room scene, which was straight out of like his horror films and purposefully done. It almost feels out of place because it was so Raimi, that one, compared to the rest of the film. Whereas the rest of it was perhaps had just had inflections. That was like full on kind of almost comic horror, that kind of the extreme looks, the lighting, all that stuff was very, very extreme.
It's just so Raimi. And I just want to talk about performances. Elizabeth Olsen deserves all the plaudits she gets for everything she does. She's phenomenal. Incredible. I really, really like, and I've not seen her in anything before this. I think this is like her second main role. But Sochi Gomez, who plays America Chavez, she's great. She's electrifying. Yep. And I kind of want to see more of her. She's brilliant. And everyone's really on point in this, I should say. But I mean, I didn't go into this thinking this was going to be what a lot of people on the internet were kind of touting this as, was the major game changer for Phase 4. Like, everything, doors will be opening.
I think foolishly, that's what I thought.
Well, maybe not foolishly, Dan. That's what that was in the zeitgeist of the internet, really. And I think that's the issue with Marvel films, is that there's this expectation, and they've made a rod for their own back, obviously. And there is an issue, obviously, the usual Marvel forte, where they have to kind of crowbar an exposition to link into other characters and other series and other films, which kind of goes back on what I said beforehand. If you think about when we first reviewed WandaVision back on, I don't know what episode of the pod, I was talking about the fact that Kevin Feige said that you don't need to watch any of the Disney Plus series. It won't matter if you miss out on those because...
That's not true.
Well, they clearly don't have much faith in that, because in Doctor Strange, there's a lot of exposition for other, you know, DC Plus series, which I think was a point you were alluding to, Dan. It does, in some respects, get in the way. But it goes at quite a pace, this film does, for me.
Yeah, I'm surprised that you said it was so sluggish I was just waiting for a moment just to sit down and catch my breath, because it just went and went and went and went and went.
We barely turned to each other. Sam, there was one moment where I turned to you, and we all know what that moment is, apart from Pete, but other than that, I couldn't tell when acts were ending. Usually you can go, okay, we're getting to act three now. Okay, yeah. Like, even in the Batman, well, the Batman had two act threes, but like, even in some films, you go, okay, yep, okay, we're about to get to the finale now. Cool, don't even need to look at my watch. Okay, I know roughly where we are now. Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness. I'll just call it Doctor Strange and Mom. Just keeps going. This propulsive kind of pace.
Never stopped. I really liked it, and I really enjoyed it. And I'm a big apologist for the first one, because I feel like even though Doctor Strange isn't my favourite character, I find it very, very difficult to find anything to feel sorry for him about, like, or empathise with him. It had some of the most incredible and most inventive scenes in a Marvel movie, and I think that the same is said for Multiverse of Madness, maybe not as visually inventive, but structurally and narratively inventive. I think that the story has a little bit of an issue where I definitely think that they've gone and done pickups after they changed the order of when films are going to be released. So this is meant to be before Spider-Man and then it's released afterwards. So there's definitely some scenes at the start that they've had to refilm to make up for that, which is where, again, I think like it starts to dip a little bit, but it very quickly picks up and it just goes and goes and goes and doesn't stop. And I think that for me, the biggest fault of this film is that it's not Doctor Strange's story. And in really, like, I felt that there's another character involved with this story that if they'd focused on them and almost tried to make you see the world from their perspective, because they're the main sort of horrific pull, like they're essentially like the monster, they're Leatherface, they're, you know, whatsoever, they're, you know, Jaws. Jason, they're Freddy, Jaws, like they're the main propulsion of terror and fear. And I think that there was an opportunity there to let them lead the film and also and let us as an audience try and come to terms with like them as a character actually going from a known quantity to this like horrific being. And there was moments when that was kind of played with and like investigated and talked about, but it was never really leaned upon because it was Doctor Strange's film. And then it's like, well, we've got to go back to Doctor Strange and the fact that like he's got unrequited love and, you know, he let Thanos get the time stone and all that kind of stuff, blah 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 blah. But it was like, he's not the most interesting character in this movie to me. Like, I'm more interested in this other character and what they're going through. And there's some incredible moments, and like I think the filmmaking is incredibly on point and it feels like it's lifted straight out of the 90s. Like, I was shocked in horror in one second and then the next second just some goofiness, just giggling with laughter. And I think like that was quite refreshing as an experience. But I, you know, I love it. And talking about that Marvel train and the fact it keeps going, keep it going, because if there's one thing that A, keeps us talking about something and keeps us engaged in something and debating about it, brilliant. And if there's something that means that, you know, once a month me and Chris can get together, go for a nice meal and again go and watch a movie together, then, you know, bring it on.
We're going on holiday, the four of us, soon.
Are we?
We are. Oh, well, I hope so. None of you paid me yet, so it'll just be me on my own in the hot tub.
I thought it was your treat.
No, I'll do that this weekend, Sam, sorry. and Sam, you know, we were chatting yesterday, and I was saying, well, what are you going to bring for this weekend? Because when was the last time the four of us actually were in the same room, physically, virtually with each other?
I want to say episode 100, but even that feels like it was so long ago.
No, I think it was more recent than that, I think.
If I look on my phone, I'll see. There's always photos of us together.
Because I wanted to use this opportunity to throw my hat in the ring for I'm thinking of bringing down.
Okay.
For two reasons. One, because I think it'd be a nice thing for us to play. And secondly, because it's got a nice little journey, because I wanted to kind of bring Merchants and Marauders, which is the game that Sam convinced me to buy from the Bring and Buy sale in Harrogate at the Aircon a few months ago. And Pete, you and I were supposed to play this game, but then both of us separately got COVID.
Yeah, that was fun, wasn't it?
Lol. so we couldn't play that, unfortunately. But I did manage to sit down with Sam and play this. And this is totally my jam at the moment. I'm literally just finishing David Cordingley's book, Under the Black Flag, which is about the history of pirates, mainly those in the Caribbean, but pirates in general, really. Everything from their depictions in films to life at sea to the types of ships they had, and getting these lovely little anecdotes about how people became pirates and the crazy stuff they got up to, really. And also you hear about other things you don't really see much in films, like how big a deal storms were, the challenges of having to kind of MOT your ship every so often, you know, careening it and, like, you know, checking it's all watertight. You can't just do that out in the ocean. You actually have to go and find somewhere secluded to do that so you don't get attacked. All this kind of stuff. And I've been hankering for a good pirate game that gives me that experience. I'm always drawn to the pirate theme. I don't know why, I just am. And I was watching it was a Dice Tower top 10 list. And they had, what's his name? Who's one of the co-creators of South Park? What's his name?
Trey Parker.
Trey Parker, yes. They had Trey Parker on, who's a massive board gamer. And he's really into thematic games. And he mentioned Merchants Marauders. He's like a really good one. If you're into your pirates, I thought, oh, great, yeah, I'll make a mental note of that. So anyway, I bought this game. I've played it a few times, and it does exactly what it says on the tin. First things first, it's a sandbox game. So when I say sandbox, essentially, you start off with your pirate ship, and you go, should I just go over there? Where I can go wherever I want, essentially, on this on this map of the Caribbean. And this game is about 12 years old now. It's designed by Casper Argard, Christian Markusson, with art by Ben Nelson, and Chris Quilliams. Try saying that three times.
Chris Quilliams. There we go. Done.
There we go. Oh, hang on. He's just appeared in the room.
Run away!
2 to 4 players. We are 4 players. Perfect.
Perfect.
Yeah, 1, 2, 3, 4. So,
well done.
It's great. So you start off with, you pick your captain, and then you look at what their special ability is. So everyone gets a slightly little ability. And then you secretly choose what your first ship is going to be. And you have a choice. Am I going to go for a sloop or a flute? And this is where the game gets its title from. Because you have to decide in that kind of...
Sloop and flutes.
Yeah, that was the B-side. Sorry. Where you kind of decide, am I going to be a merchant? Therefore, I'm going to go for a flute. So it's got a bigger cargo hold, but it's not as it doesn't maneuver as well. Or do I go for a sloop, where it's all about being zooming across the Caribbean as quick as you can, picking fights left, right, and centre, and then trying to avoid the Navy. So you've got your ship, and you've got your little player board, and you can track the health of your ship, you have the hull integrity, the masts and all that stuff, your cargo holds, how much cannon you've got, and you just travel across the Caribbean, seeking glory. And the first person to 10 glory points wins the game.
Brilliant.
And you get free action points per round. You move. You can scout. You think, I'm going to scout here. I'm going to attack a ship here. And then it's just dice chucking and things. Or I'm going to go to a port and I'm going to sell some goods because I know they really need spices on this part of the Caribbean. And look, as luck would have it, I've got some spices in my hold and I can get some money here. Superb. Or I'm going to buy goods here. Or I'm going to visit a shipyard because I've got so much cash now, I can pimp up my ship and make it bigger. Or I'm going to acquire rumour because that's how I can also get a glory point. Oh, there's rumour of a treasure over here. Oh, I'm going to go over there and have a look for it. Great. Bye. Or I can claim a mission. Or I can stash my gold. And this is what I love. Every player gets their own little miniature chest. And you can just, when you go home, you can stash some gold away. And you do it secretly because every 10 gold you've got, that's one glory point. And you don't know. Somebody could get to 6 glory points and go, cool, I've just won the game. And they'll open up their treasure and you think, oh my word, when did you stockpile all of that? And you may be thinking, well, it's me and Sam, the whole Caribbean. What's the player interaction like here? Is that much of a challenge or are you and Sam just going on a jolly?
Well, I imagine you're in costume, firstly.
Indeed. I really love it. I think any other theme wouldn't be interested. It probably wouldn't make sense, actually, of any other theme, thinking about it. But I really, really like this game. It's really, really lovely. And I think it will be perfect for our holiday if it's raining outside.
Yeah, it is nice and gentle. It'll be interesting to play it with more players when the board is a bit congested and people are playing like different roles. It was very simple for me and you just to basically be like traders on the ocean. And basically the game was a bit like a trading game where we were just buying goods, moving them and selling them and tracking down like rumors and stuff. And the more I could express the piratical part of me, the more I enjoyed the game. So, for example, like Chris hinted at Rumours. Like, I really loved the Rumours thing because it was very much like you've gone to a bar in a port somewhere and someone's said a whisper of someone like, I've heard that the Spanish princess is getting married. And if you go to this port this day, you're in for a bounty or like a payday. And you get to the port and it's a bit of a shame that you just roll a dice and if you succeed or fail, that tells you if the rumour's, you know, true or not. But there's always a nice thing where Chris, and I could tell he was getting slightly annoyed at this, when he'd be like, what's the rumour? What's the rumour? What's the rumour? And I'd be like, none of your business. I was just keeping all these rumours to myself.
So Sam goes into his cosmic encounter mode.
Yeah. Talking of games I'm going to bring, I'm bringing Cosmic Encounter.
Of course you bloody well are, definitely.
It's a classic.
Because I tell you why, Dan, and because of this, you can't refuse not to play it, and you can't refuse to play it, because that is the last game that we all play together, and indeed that is the last time we are all together on the 22nd of February 2020. And so I think that that kind of role-playing, which this sandbox sort of allows, is where this game really comes to life. And I think with two players just being like traders and doing like the odd sort of bounty and getting involved with little scraps kind of works. But I think it'll really come to life when there's four players and there's people who are really, you know, like doing proper trading and like protecting trade routes from pirates and like taking down pirate ships, or pirates who are actually have like big trading boats to aim for and actually attack and try and take down, which is kind of what we didn't have in our game. So like, even though for us, Chris, I think it was a nice, jolly, sort of relaxing sort of little sailing around the Caribbean adventure, I think with more players, I'm predicting now that it's not going to be that relaxing, like chilled out affair. I think there's going to be quite a lot of instances where we may be, oh, why did you attack me? Like, leave me alone. And like Pete, you're like, the battles themselves are proper like miniatures games, rolling, like we're rolling for armor, we're rolling for damage.
Right.
It's not just rolling dice and who gets the bigger numbers.
There's some crunch.
Yes, it's good. And I do think, and this is, you know, this is kind of like, you know, the big thought about games we're going to play, which is on our holiday, because I'm already getting overexcited, not just about playing games with all you guys, but just seeing you all and just like all the wonderful things that we're going to actually get to do and together, which haven't done in ages. I mean, I'll be in a bathroom half the time with a bloody skin cleansing.
As a question, do we all get to bring one game and play one game, no questions asked?
I was just thinking this.
I mean, this is danger to accept, mainly because of a smile that is currently crossing Pete's face. a smile which is Joker-esque.
I mean, I quite like this idea because A, I always bring too much and it never gets played. B, I generally have a game which I really, really, really want to play. I don't know. Part of me really wants to say yes.
I think it'd be a good idea because I think often when we get together, Sam sees it as an opportunity to just play all the games he hasn't been able to play yet. And like, we're in like a locked room, like, you can't get away, I'm playing these games. So if that stops Sam doing that.
Well, okay, good. Then we're agreed. That's what's definitely happening.
Oh, look at him. He's looking off screen. He's got his eye on it.
We have reached an accord.
Oh, God, he's going to bring Scythe, isn't he? Oh, God.
No. No, if you think you're getting away with Scythe.
He's bringing like Battletech or something.
Yeah, he's going to be like, what was the one he got from the Christmas present? Like, there we go, Advanced Squad Leader.
Oh, gosh, I love that box cover.
Remember, Pete, we've only got like 36 hours together.
Yeah, you can squeeze...
The weather could be pants.
Yeah, you can squeeze ASL into 36 hours, easy.
And remember, the aim is to kind of for us to enjoy ourselves as well.
Oh, well...
Connect Four it is.
We'll each enjoy ourselves individually with our own game, but not when playing anyone else's.
Yeah, exactly. See, they made FIFA 22 a PS Plus game.
They did. It's almost like Sony have a brand new PlayStation Plus model on the horizon, and getting in new subscribers now would be pretty good. I'm on the fence about that new PlayStation Plus model.
I think it's a joke.
I think that me like Dan, I've got PlayStation Plus like basically piled stacked until about 2024, maybe 2025. So I think that what I'm going to do is I'm going to upgrade for a year, which I think is about like £32, to the next tier, which is like PlayStation Extreme or PlayStation Rivals or something like that. And just see, because there's bound to be enough like PlayStation 4 / PlayStation 5 games on that surface that will mean I'll get my money's worth for a year.
I mean, me and Sam have really talked about the fact of like Returnal is a game that we actually are both quite interested in, and that would be that would be part of it. So you think when you start to factor in how many, for the cost it's going to take, how many games would I need that I actually want to play for it to kind of make its money back? So Returnal kind of would cost a lot of money to buy. But if it's part of that, then actually, like, you know what? If I could get Returnal and maybe one other game, two other games, that would kind of cover the financial impact of doing it. And then obviously anything
just
extra,
for a year,
anything extra would be great.
Yeah, but like, we live in a world of Xbox like Ultimate, which is which is unbelievable value.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Right? Like, and like, yeah, I get it. Like, if we look over in we're scared of the internet Nintendo corner, like, this is a much better deal. Like, this is a really, really good deal for a year's worth of stuff, right? Like, but like, you go and look at the Xbox stuff and it is just night and day. Like, they are just spending money to acquire players. Like, and fair enough, I mean, they've got that office money to spend on it, but like, I don't know, like, some of the stuff that's like, one of those tiers was like, oh, you get PlayStation Now and it does X, Y, and Z, and like, but it was like, it was a lot of money for a year.
But that's all the PS3 games, isn't it, and stuff. I'm like, that's, you know what, I've got too many games to play anyway, I can't be going that far back.
I find it very, I think that the offering that they have is, it doesn't go far enough to do the Xbox thing, which is like, obviously the dream, right? Like, oh, do you want brand new games?
It's obviously like, you'd be losing so much money, like the amount of money that goes, but because of that, you get so many people coming in that it almost breaks even kind of thing. You have to kind of,
I'm sure there's some smart business model somewhere where they're like, in 5 years, we will be breaking even on whatever.
And then we will have everyone playing Xbox.
Every player. Because I've got to be honest with you, I'm looking at that next generation and I'm seeing the Series X and I'm thinking to myself, if I've got to pay for it anyway, maybe I just don't pay for games anymore.
Yeah, but then you'd be playing by yourself. And then the number one reason you have PlayStation Plus is to play with friends, and you wouldn't have any friends to play with.
Right. But like, that is it. Imagine if I could just click my fingers and say, okay, everybody's got them now. That is what I would do, because it's just like, yeah, like, it's the Netflix model. Like, it feels like Microsoft has basically like really lent into the Netflix model of, you don't really own any of your games. You just pay an ongoing subscription and we'll just keep you giving you really great content. And the content will be king. Like as long as we can give you that great content, and we'll work with loads of different partners to do that, to bring that to our service, you'll keep paying us X amount of money every single month. And that X amount of money is less than the price of a brand new game. And you probably buy maybe one game every month, maybe every couple of months, that kind of thing. Like, that is incredible value. Whereas the PlayStation one is like, hey, do you remember Mafia on the PS3? Do you fancy giving that a spin again?
And that's the thing. That's why I look at it from a financial perspective of, okay, it's going to cost me X amount of money. How many games do I actually want as a result of this? If the number of games that I want outweighs the cost, then I'm interested. If it doesn't, and that's the thing. At the moment, they've only really released like a handful of games, which Returnal was part of. And I was like, okay, I'm interested in playing that. I want to see what else is in this little selection, because it could just be they've released these 10 games, which are great. And then the rest of it is, I don't know, Leisure Suit Larry VR kind of thing. I'm like, I mean, that sounds tops, but now I'm all right.
Definitely want to wipe that VR headset clean after you've used that one, I would say. You can get a physical copy now of a game called Procession to Calvary. You can import it from Asia if you like. You can burn a load of fuel to get it sent across the ocean. It's about 3 hours long, folks, and it will cost you about £30 to import it. So I didn't do that. I bought the digital copy instead. And let me tell you...
Oh, I really wanted to play this game.
Oh, Chris. The Procession to Calvary is fantastic. Is it worth £30? I mean, maybe. I definitely think it's worth the £4 or whatever it was that I paid to play it on mobile. And tablet, which is where I ended up playing.
I have seen this game. Sorry, I just had a quick look. I have seen this game. And I actually, yeah, I've considered buying it in the past.
So the way I can explain this the best is, do you remember the intro to Monty Python?
Yeah.
Yes.
It's sort of that.
Terry Gillingham.
Yeah, it's sort of that kind of cut out real images that sort of all kind of work together, sort of don't, with a slightly absurd sense of humour and a slightly dark sense of humour, but based on usually Renaissance paintings. And this is the follow-up to the original title, which I believe is called something like The Four Last Things. And you don't have to have played Four Last Things to enjoy The Procession to Calvary. But if you have, then you will get a little bit extra out of it, because there's a couple of nods and winks here and there to that previous game. This isn't the first game that this developer put together. That was a kind of weird-looking game that I've not played yet, and I'm quite keen on giving it a go, but it was kind of really, really hodgepodge in terms of like its visual stylings. Whereas Four Last Things started to do the... It was a Kickstarter project. It started to do the, hey, let's take Renaissance paintings, cut the bits out, and then create a point-and-click adventure in the style of your Monkey Islands, your Broken Swords, your... Gabriel Knight's Sins of the Fathers. As I say, it's only a few hours long, which I think is, funnily enough, I think probably the perfect length for an adventure game. I think games like Bertram Fiddle, for example, get it right by having it only a few hours long.
Yeah.
Because there's only so much point-and-click adventure that you really want until you're like, yeah, I get it. I'm rubbing this thing against this thing, and then the door opens, right? Like that's what a huge part of it is. But this one is, it stars a main character who is somewhat bloodthirsty, and there's been a big war, and they've returned from that war, and now they're not allowed to kill anyone. But they've been given an adventure. They've been given a mission, and they have to go and complete this mission. And you then set about wandering around medieval, Renaissance, that kind of era paintings as this character trying to solve all of these problems and confronting the kind of strangeness of paintings from the era. So if you're not particularly au fait with the paintings of that time, they're weird. They're like really, really weird. Yeah. Like, there are depictions of hell, for example, from around that period of time, where there's, like, an egg witch, and out of her butt are, like, naked dudes, and they're just, like, falling to the ground and then being eaten by devils. It's really strange. And it's just... And then there are, like, scenes... So there's a really good one in the Bristol Museum, actually, of a scene in Bristol. And the paint... It's absurd. Like, it's just like a festivity day, and just chaos is happening. Like, because they're trying to capture, like, they're not trying to capture, like, a moment. They're trying to capture lots of different moments all at the same time. And because of that, it just looks like chaos. And that's what happens in a lot of these paintings from around that era. So one of the classic jokes early on is you wander down to the to a place where you're going to get onto a boat and travel across a body of water, and there is, from a real painting from the time, two men stripped completely naked, wrestling one another over just some detritus objects on the floor, right? Like, it's just a painting that was done at that period of time. I'm sure it means something like masculinity, or I don't know, like faith, something. I'm sure it has some representational value. But like, the joke is that the main character goes up to it and says, "Just some naked guys having a load of fun." Like, you know, just kind of making it normal, right? About like, yeah, this is just a thing that happened at this period of time, right? As if the paintings were some sort of replication of the things they actually saw, these painters actually saw.
Yeah.
And it's wonderful. Like, it runs the gamut from, there are moments of real darkness, of like black humor. Like, really black humor, where you're like, this is a bit close to the bone. And like, then there's moments of incredible satire, because obviously around this period of time, you know, the church had a lot of power. There's a lot of satire around that. But again, in a playful way, not in a sort of like, you know, sort of second year theology student kind of way, but in a genuinely like, actually for good laughs kind of stuff. And then there's also just kind of absurd moments where one of the puzzles, you meet the girl with the turquoise earring, and she says, "I think there's something just isn't working out about my look," and it's down to you to figure out how you get the girl with the turquoise earring to be happy.
What are the puzzles like then? It seemed to me when I saw stuff about this game that it was more a satire and more a commentary than it was an actual, like, puzzle game. So where does it have a balance in that respect, or is it just a piece of satire?
Yeah, definitely. The thing about pretty much all point-and-click adventures is ultimately that they are one big escape room. You might be in like lots and lots and lots of different escape rooms as you're following George Stobart around, you know, different parts of the world. But at the end of the day, you can't really progress without rubbing the right item against a different item and the door opening, right? Like that is ultimately it. But the puzzles themselves, I mean, yeah, like I say, it isn't abstract, but you can definitely feel that is the mechanism that is happening. But that's fine. Like, it doesn't ever try to get over any sort of... It's not trying to tell a particularly serious tale. And there is, like, social and, to more of an extent, a kind of, like, an art critique in some ways, element to this. But I don't want to overblow it. Like, it goes from that kind of highbrow humour all the way down to the sort of lowbrow stuff. And it does it, like, really, really effortlessly. Like I say, import it from a PlayAsia? Probably not. But... I mean, like, I would have paid twice, three times what I paid for it on mobile, and I paid £4. Like, it is a lovely, lovely romp.
Yeah, that was an episode of the Staying In podcast with myself, Sam Turner, Peter Whittington, Daniel Frost, and Chris Darby. Thank you very much for listening to this episode that you've just heard. We really do appreciate having you around. Just a quick couple of messages. You may have heard these before. If not, please just stay and listen, because we really want to continue this relationship after the show is finished. And to do that, all you need to do is go to Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and you can just search for @StayingInPod. If you don't want to use any of those specific websites, then you can just get in touch with us via other means. Send us an email, stayinginpod@gmail.com. You can go to stayinginpodcast.com com to see more ways of reaching out and getting in touch with us if you would like to. We'd like to hear what you have to say. Is there something that we should be playing, watching, seeing, listening, experiencing that we've yet to mention so far on all 151 episodes of this show? Let us know. Tell us about it. Or has there been something that you've checked out because we loved it too? That'd be lovely to hear that we're spreading some good through the world. Any other messages? What have we got? Oh yeah, we've got a Spotify playlist. Details of how to get to that are in the show notes of this particular episode. We've also got curated pages on Board Game Geek and Steam. So if there's any video games or board games that you may be interested in, you can get some more information on our curated pages there. And I think that's it. That's all the messages I've got. Just, you know, probably just end on saying another great thank you for spending your time listening to us and listening to this show. If you feel inclined, then share the fact that you listen to it with a friend, a family maker, a colleague, someone that you know, because, you know, we really appreciate that too. Anyway, till next time, we'll see you soon. Bye-bye.